perfect silence. And that is something that I relish, surrounded by this perfect silence.
One of the first things you have to focus on is, let's not get killed by accident down here. Exposure to the elements can kill you within an hour.
I'm Shabnam Grewal, and this is The Y Factor on the BBC World Service. It's the coldest, highest, driest, and windiest continent on Earth. Antarctica. Today we're asking, why are so many people drawn to this frozen continent? But this isn't a programme about climate change or polar ice melting or the sea levels rising. It's a programme exploring the connection between individual human beings and this extreme and beautiful place.
The sound of silence. All I can hear is a light breeze and the soft sea in the distance and my own breathing. All around me there's a blanket of thick, white snow. It does feel like I'm the only person in the whole world.
That was me many years ago on a visit to Rothera, a British research station off the Antarctic Peninsula. Around 30 countries have a presence on the continent under the Antarctic Treaty, an international agreement to protect this unique environment. And over the last 100 years or so, we have actually learned quite a lot about Antarctica, and it's no longer a place we can fill with imaginary creatures and strange beings. No longer an unknown land, or terra incognita.
Terra incognita used to be vast, and it was a lot of the map, so you would have, Europe, and then everything else on the map was terra incognita.
Kim Stanley Robinson is a science fiction writer. For his novel Antarctica, he spent several months on the continent. This icy landscape drew him in with its cold, inscrutable, alien mystery, its emptiness.
In the 19th century, the last places left that were truly unknown became the baskets where we threw all of our strange ideas about what could have been out there. Like the ancient Greeks with their idea that were people who had their faces in their chests, there were headless people, there were people with two heads, etc. The whole imaginary that needed another place in order to believe that it really existed, that went away to the point where Antarctica was the only place left that we didn't know enough about that we could say, well, it's not there. Well, now we know. There is a station at the South Pole, and there's an incredibly good mapping going on. So even Antarctica's gone, and so now we've kind of gone off planet for those kind of strange thoughts.
My name is Felicity Aston, and I'm a polar explorer.
That is the coolest job title in the whole world, isn't it?
If you say polar explorer, everybody knows that what you do for a living is drag sledges on skis across big white snowy places.
Felicity Aston is one of three people and the only woman to have crossed Antarctica from one side to the other, alone and pulling a sledge carrying everything she needed to stay alive. She's firmly part of the heroic tradition of Antarctic explorers, like Amundsen, Shackleton and Scott, going into the unknown, enduring immense physical hardship, and sometimes facing great danger.
I remember a moment when I was skiing alone in Antarctica and it was a real blizzard. I couldn't see any sense of space around me at all. There was no form, no colour, no contrast, no sense of distance or orientation or anything. And it was really frightening. So you've got these really strong winds and there was half of my brain paralysed with fear, saying, no, I'm going to die in this storm. I'm going to fall down a crevasse and no one's ever going to see me again. And, you know, this is just the worst thing I've ever experienced in my whole life. And yet there was another part of my brain that was euphoric, going, wow, look at this. Look at where you are. You are in the middle of Antarctica, in the middle of a blizzard, and you are moving forward. You are being the polar explorer that you dreamed of being as a kid. You know, this is what life is for.
Kim Stanley Robinson's novel about Antarctica, written more than 20 years ago, explored what might happen if the Antarctic Treaty fell apart.
I was thinking, oh yes, if this place were endangered by commercial interests who tried to dig out the oil that is underneath the ice or went for the minerals, if the Antarctic Treaty fell apart, there would be locals to resist any exploitation. There would be eco-terrorism. There would be diplomatic attempts to restore the treaty and protect Antarctica from exploitation. And as I got the notions, the whole plot kind of fell in place within about an hour. And it was well after midnight. I was staying up late, but it was a completely brilliantly sunny. And it was a great moment for me because at that point I was reassured that I had a story to tell.
In the novel, as well as eco-terrorists who blow up the mining interests, there are also small groups of people who surreptitiously and secretly live on the continent, scavenging from old polar stations and catching fish to eat. People who see themselves as Antarcticans. I think some people could claim to be, or at least to have become, Antarcticans. Like the people who work on polar research stations and spend long, dark winters there, sometimes year after year. They are a very special breed.
You have to be the kind of person that would enjoy small-town life, and I mean village life, where you only have 100 people to deal with for about 6 months. And then also the lack of sunlight, the total darkness, and the extreme conditions. It really is like living on a spaceship already. You can go outdoors, but it's like an extra vehicular activity. You have to gear up for it. Sometimes you have to stay on a line even if there's wind. And so that's a strange situation. And the U.S. Antarctic Program regards it as psychological hardship.
Polar explorer Felicity Aston first came to Antarctica as a meteorologist for the British Antarctic Survey on a 39-month contract. Because Antarctica is so remote and difficult to get to, that meant that for more than 3 years she was stuck on the continent, no trips home or to visit other countries. So during the Antarctic winter, when the sun set and didn't rise again for months, and the sea all around her froze and planes couldn't land, Felicity and two other women and 20 men lived, sometimes in total darkness, with only each other for company. You'd think it might make some people a little odd.
Yeah, it's hard to tell sometimes who arrived that way and who has sort of gone that way as a consequence. I remember there was one colleague on base my first winter who decided that, you know, he would do his 8 hours of work a day, but he would sleep until he woke up, he would eat when he was hungry, and he would just work for 8 hours. You know, by the end of the winter, it was really noticeable that he was struggling. Perhaps you wouldn't even see him for a few days in a row because he'd be totally out of sync with everyone else, so he'd be working while everyone else was asleep. I think that lack of social contact does strange things to people after a while, and he wasn't very happy. Some people became quite cliquey, some people started drinking a lot, some people started eating a lot, and other people spent a lot of time in the environment out in Antarctica, which sounds wonderful, but it starts drawing you away from the group and it sort of messes with your perspective a bit and how easy it is to become quite paranoid.
Natalie Patton is a Belgian doctor and psychologist who's been to Antarctica 6 times. She's researched how people's behaviour can be affected by living in extreme and controlled environments, like an Antarctic base.
For some, it's an incredible sense of freedom. They feel it liberates them from basically having to organise their lives. They don't have to run errands, they don't have to go grocery shopping, they don't have to pay bills. And for others, it feels like a very institutionalised life. And when you talk with people at the end of an overwintering who have spent anything between, let's say, a year or a year and a half on a base, it's one of the things that they cite frequently when they get back to the normal world, the ability to choose simple things like, what food am I going to cook? When am I going to wake up? Can I take a day off?
The history of Antarctic exploration that I learned was a very British one, with plucky Englishmen struggling through perilous and treacherous blizzards to heroic tragedy. Men like explorer Lawrence Oates, who, knowing he wouldn't make it back to base and not wanting to slow down his colleagues, walked out into a raging blizzard and certain death with the words, "I'm just going outside and maybe sometime." I find this myth-making a little sentimental, but also incredibly alluring and an invitation to be part of something big. But mostly Antarctica is a place of science, and that's why people with no interest in heroics or the cold go there to work.
I'm Foster Mashele from South Africa, but currently I'm in Antarctica, South African Antarctica base Sanai 4. We are the only African station.
Foster is a scientist and engineer and wanted to come to Antarctica to improve his future work prospects. He was overjoyed when he got accepted onto the programme, but the timing couldn't have been worse. Your wife gave birth to your child just 2 weeks before you left. That must have been hard.
Yeah, it has been hard, yeah, because for the first daughter it was much easier because I was around to help. But with the second one it was not that easy because I only have to be there for 2 weeks and then I have to leave them behind. So it is frustrating. I just encourage myself by saying, like, it's for the best because it really opened my eyes career-wise. I have got lots of time to do lots of research to understand how things work. So that's what helped me to keep on going.
Some of the science done in Antarctica is about the place itself, the geology, the waters around the continent, or the climate. Other scientists come because the pristine environment and remote location means their research can be more precise and accurate.
What I've been doing today as scientist engineer is my duty to look after the instruments, the equipment, the loggers. The system are logging data every minute, every second, and transfer data back to South Africa. Antarctica, it's so special because there's less interference. So when you deal with frequency, you try by all means to minimize any unwanted noise or interference because we are next to the magnetic South Pole. It's much easier to monitor the changes of the magnetic field of the Earth.
Right now, it's still dark outside, but not as dark as it has been. The extremes of light and dark can cause problems. When I was in Antarctica, I found the almost 24-hour daylight made my eyes gritty and painful. But too much light or too little light can also affect your mental well-being. An interest in this area is what brought Belgian doctor and psychologist Natalie Patton to Antarctica.
It does affect your sleep because obviously your body clock, which is normally adjusted to one daylight and one nighttime epoch over the course of 24 hours, over there, when you have the constant daylight, goes slightly amiss. And so it does affect your sleep. However, it's very energizing to be constantly submitted to that daylight. And so when you first arrive, the first couple of days, you never want to go to sleep. And so in the data that we recorded, it showed indeed that people's sleep was heavily affected.
Beauty is something people talk about all the time, but it's more than that. Kim Stanley Robinson remembers looking out from an American base in Antarctica towards the nearby mountains.
Maybe beauty isn't the right word because it's so stark and immediately it strikes you that it's a deadly place. It's a combination of beauty and terror that makes for sublimity. So the Antarctic is sublime in this sense that things are huge, they're white, they're cold, they're immensely simple and stark. Yes, you could die here in an hour if you didn't have the proper protections. So there is an undercurrent of terror in the whole experience, and it does resemble space travel.
Polar explorer Felicity Aston has travelled across Greenland, the Arctic, and to the South Pole. She's experienced, knowledgeable, and loves Antarctica. And yet, when she was about to begin her solo expedition across the continent, it was almost too much.
I thought I'd prepared really well for feeling alone in perhaps one of the loneliest continents in the world. It turned out I really hadn't prepared at all. I remember standing there and watching the plane become a tiny little black blob in the sky and disappearing, and then waiting until I couldn't hear its engines anymore. And then I just became aware that, you know, I was breathing hard, I was shaking, being unnaturally clumsy for me, and I thought, my goodness, I'm absolutely terrified. I don't think I've ever felt this level of fear. And it was just that huge, sudden pressure of isolation, the shock of it, of knowing that there was no one for maybe 600-700 kilometres in any direction.
Hello.
And within 4 days, I was in a part of the Transantarctic Mountains where I was going up through the mountains in a very narrow glacier where the wind whistles through from the plateau to the coast. So it's very windy, it's very narrow, it's very steep. And there was just no way a plane could get in there to come get me, even in life or death. There's just no way. And that fear never really went away. You know, people often ask me, oh, how did you conquer that fear? And I don't think I ever did.
Antarctica forces you to reveal who you are and what you're made of. That's part of the attraction for many people, including psychologist Natalie Patton.
It literally strips you down from everything that normally holds you together as a person. So you're forced to consider yourself in a whole new daylight. You see people at their truest. If they're in pain, if they're scared, if they're dealing with an emergency in their lives, it kind of strips you to your bare bones, to the essence of who you are.
You've been listening to The Why Factor on the BBC World Service. I'm Shabnam Grewal. The producer was Smita Patel, and it was mixed by James Beard. If you enjoyed this edition of The Why Factor, you may like other outdoor episodes on mountains, the sea, and the pilgrimage. You can find them at bbc.com/Why Factor.
I just spent the night in a tent on a glacier on my own, and someone's coming to get me and to get the other people who've also been spending the night here. Hello? In fact, they haven't been coming to get me. They've been going off skiing. I suppose I'll just have to sit here for a bit longer until someone comes to get me. I hope they haven't forgotten.
I mean, you gotta let it carry you.
Who lasts? Glass lasts. Who lasts? Glass lasts. Who lasts longest? Grass lasts longest.
Grass lasts. Wet bar wax, bleached in gold.
A garden house, organic flow. A friendly first.
Inside shorts.
On tap and terracotta. Be the first of your friends to like Greek yogurt this summer. Our liquor special. Aloe vera.
Terracotta.
Baked in earth. Wet bar wax. Claimed and active for such a cash. Iced naturals add to dash over curved plastic pressed in mold. Over curved plastic pressed in molds.
For easy shares.
Use the bonus for found funds when you feel.
For salvage.
In distressed denim for easy share. Claims inactive for salvage cash.
Can you believe and
brown cow. Stunning.
Let there be a thousand blossoms worthy sparks off the sun.
You're the homosexual.
I care about you.
Go, man.
No, I'm not going.
Get this done.
Hello.
It's Patrick.
And also Ruby.
And we're coming to you with It's a Gay Area to SCR 107.3 from the past.
From the past. So, if we fast track to now, which is Friday, well, today it's Monday for us, but when you're listening, it will be Friday and I will be in Melbourne. So,
what will you be doing in Melbourne?
It's confidential. No, it's not. My partner is going to be on Millionaire Hot Seat. And it's very funny because they're not actually telling us when it's going to air. So I guess we just have to keep watching Millionaire Hot Seat for the rest of the time.
Don't
that
plug
airing.
That show.
Sorry, Billionaire Hot Pot. the show where everyone makes a hot pot filled with gold.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this, I am dead.
Yeah. If you're listening to this, I am dead and I'm coming for you as a ghost.
To find my murderer, follow these clues coming up in the show.
We will be saying certain words and you just have to pinpoint them out. We're not going to tell you which words they are, but pinpoint certain words and see what kind of message you get. The killer is. That's the first one. Just a little hint for you.
ScoMo.
That's not one of them.
Yeah.
Do we just wanted to say it?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's happening on the show today, Patrick?
I don't know.
Oh, no.
No, I joke. I do know I run this show with Ruby.
Yeah,
she is a co-runner. And we're talking about films, specifically ones with the gay.
Yeah, we're talking about the queer film industry.
Queer film industry. And we have a special guest on who is Lisa Rose, Festival Director of Queer Screen.
How very, very exciting. And Lisa was just an absolute hoot to have her in the studio.
We mean she will be an absolute hoot to have in the studio because this is present time.
This is present time and definitely not from the past.
Yeah.
See, you can't see because it's the radio, but Patrick and I are winking at each other every single time we say the present.
And I have aged greatly.
Mm,
and how many more jokes can we make from the fact that this is not a live show?
This is not a live show. Well, first of all, sorry.
Whoopsie. Don't worry. We're going to force our producers to stay here in the empty room.
Yeah, you bet. They're going to come into the studio and just sit. It's going to be awesome.
I'm kidding. We're nice.
No, we're lovely. And our producers are lovely. So, yeah, we'll be talking all about film. And Lisa will be coming in because it's the present. We winked once again.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about, of course, we'll have our segment. What do we think about it, though?
I'm so sorry if I'm yelling at you.
It's okay.
Like
to me or to them?
To our lovely listeners and also to you.
And our viewers.
Yeah, and our viewers. Yeah. They're there. Hi.
There they are. It's a window.
Yeah, there is a window in the studio. We should do a virtual tour, a Skype tour.
Yeah, 360
Tweet at us if you'd be interested in that, at 2SER.
Yeah.
At Patrick Baker Clancy or Patrick B. Clancy. Patrick B. Clancy.
Patrick Doobie Clancy.
No, it's Patrick B. Clancy. Please don't. Follow me on Twitter. I'm so lonely. Same on Instagram.
Yeah. And follow me on Bebo and maybe MySpace.
Yeah.
And any forum that talks about Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
I love that. We'll talk about that later, but I love that game.
If
you want an episode on Star Wars the Old Republic, because I think you can be gay in it.
You can be gay.
You can date
a
cat lady.
We will, in the near future, be doing a topic on games, very specifically games that do involve queer themes.
Yeah, because me and Ruby are gamers.
I'm big nerd.
Big nerd.
I'm big nerd.
She plays D&D.
I do. And you know what? It's fun. It's great.
It is fun. I went along one day and it was really good.
It's really, really good.
Yeah.
So I think it's about time to go into a song.
It is. And what are we listening to, Ruby?
We are listening to probably my favorite song this week. It is Career Boy by Dorian Electra. Now, let's just smack it. Let's just smack it on.
Just whack it in.
You're listening to It's a Gay Area with Patrick and Ruby on 2SER 107.3.
Career boy, working overtime. Career boy, one thing on my mind. A cheap office coffee, these pumping through my veins. I work for the man, yeah, but you know I love the change. I can see, baby, baby, that it's lonely at the time. Yeah. Career boy, nothing is ever gonna make me stop. Business and pleasure, I like to mix the two.
Mix it up, mix it up.
Hanging in the break room, I'm mixing.
Was Dorian Electra with It's No. That was Dorian Electra with It's a Gay Area. You're here on Career Boy on 2SER 107.3.
And I'm Patrick and this is Ruby.
Yeah.
So that was Career Boy by Dorian Electra. And you are listening to It's a Gay Area with Patrick and Ruby.
2SER 107.3. But we have our special guest in the studio with us now. It's Lisa Rose, the festival director of Queer Screen. Amazing talent. So fantastical.
Really good stuff. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. All right. First question right off the bat. What has been your personal experience working in the queer film industry?
Oh, wow. That's a big question to start off with.
It's always best.
Well, basically, I started volunteering with Queer Screen in 2012 because I had had a 10-year relationship ended and I needed to find something to do with all of that time. So volunteering for a queer organisation was an excellent decision. I made a whole bunch of new friends. I made had lots of new skills and lots of fun and all that sort of jazz. And then I joined the board and I was on that for about 5 or 6 years. And then I was dedicating probably anywhere between, depending on the time of the year, 10 to 30 hours a week with Queer Screen, and I loved it. And then when the job of festival director came up, I was like, what am I doing with my life? I'm 40. I'm working in a job that I don't care about, that just pays the bills. So why don't I change my career? So I did. And now I get to watch movies and I get paid for it. Obviously, that's not the whole thing that I do. But that is a large chunk. I get to, you know, I'm a professional lesbian. It's pretty exciting.
Oh, that's the dream, isn't it?
Getting paid to be a lesbian.
Yeah.
God.
That's not porn. Hey, but, hey, each to their own.
No disrespect.
No, absolutely.
So how do you think the attitudes like towards queer film have changed over time? Or like even the time you've worked at Queer Screen?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many more queer films being made. The standard of the films that are getting made now is higher than when I first started 6 years ago. And also when I first started going to the festival 18 years ago, the quality of the films that we show, I think, as a film are just of just a higher standard. There's also just so many more that are being made. There's so much more diversity in not only gender and sexuality, but the people of colour and ability and all that sort of stuff, which is great. However, there's also more stuff going to the mainstream, which is also fantastic as well. But the stuff that's going to the mainstream is probably a little bit lacking in diversity. Mm-hmm. So that's why festivals like ours are so incredibly important still, to be able to show the whole sort of gamut of the LGBTIQ experience.
And in terms of diversity, I did see a really fun tweet the other day, because that's all I do. I'll just look at tweets. And it was a tweet about the sort of film selection, the queer film selection on Netflix. It was just like, I love how Netflix thinks that 648 gay male films and 7 lesbian films make a queer section.
Yes, I read about that this morning, actually.
So what is, like, I know that in recent years you've been trying to get equal films made by women and men on the sort of program at Queer Screen. Yeah. So how's that going?
It's going really well. So we have 2 festivals a year. We have Queer Screen's Mardi Gras Film Festival, which will have its 26th festival in February. And then we have Queer Screen Film Fest, which is our smaller festival, and it's 6th rendition happening in September. And I've actually managed to get 55% of the program. Well, there's 29 films, and 55% of the program is directed or co-directed by women.
Hell yeah.
Which is, I'm super excited about. And it wasn't too difficult to make that happen, but it also was helped by the size of the festival. For Mardi Gras, when we have 70 sessions, it will be more of a challenge to get parity or more than parity for films by women or diverse people. Just because of the fact that there's not as many films being made. In the short film category, there's just so many films that are getting made by women now. The lesbian shorts, which are on Sunday, are currently selling more than the gay male shorts, which I'm super excited about. And it's probably my favourite shorts package I've ever programmed. It's so good. I highly recommend it.
I'd love if someone just tuned in and didn't think we were talking about queer films at all and just thought we were talking about shorts, very specifically male and female shorts.
As in the ones that we wear?
The ones that we wear.
Yeah.
You know?
So do you think, well, on the topic of how there isn't much diversity in the more mainstream stuff, do you think we'll ever get to a point where films involving LGBTQI plus people and themes will be kind of looked at the same as any other film, like in the near future, hopefully?
That's a good question. Like, I mean, obviously it is changing, and there's quite a few. So last year, the last probably year and a bit, there's been quite a few sort of gay male films that have broken through to the mainstream. And there's a couple more that are doing that this year, but there's also a few lesbian films that are coming to the mainstream. Like, we obviously had Disobedience and The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which have both gotten, both getting released here. And there's a couple of lesbian films that have played at, have just been announced to be playing at Toronto, the Toronto International Film Festival, and they will probably get cinematic release here as well. So there definitely are more, and there's definitely going to be more, but we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
Because they're still, unlike Moonlight, obviously, which won the Oscar, like that was a bit of an anomaly because it was about a person of colour. Like, all of these films are not. They're all about cisgender white people generally.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of cisgender white people.
Yes.
My dear co-host here, Ruby, coined a term last week of Scarlett Johanssoning.
Yeah.
When Scarlett Johansson gets cast to play someone she should not be playing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there has been quite a bit of a hubbub around the use of straight and or cisgender actors being put in LGBTQI plus roles, such as Scarlett Johansson. I believe it was Dante Tex-Gil from
For Rub and Tug.
Yeah. Mm. So... how do you think, like, what's your opinion on situations like that when that happens?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I talk to a lot of people in the trans community, and some people don't care. Some people it's really important. We think it's really important. We do play films where cisgender actors are playing trans roles, but we try and balance it. Mm-hmm. And we always find that if there's a trans actor playing a trans role, it's just so much more authentic. A film won our audience award a few years ago. I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. It's called Boy Meets Girl, and it showed Michelle Hendley. And just having her as a trans actress playing a trans role was just, it was so much more authentic. And it's like, it's a rom-com. I've never seen a trans rom-com before. When I saw that film. But I think one of the things for me, the biggest thing is with the Scarlett Johansson thing, and the thing that people were getting, people who don't understand, is the fact that if they weren't going to cast a trans actor, they needed to cast a man, because it's it's that thing of people,
it still pushes the whole thing that, like, oh, trans people are just dressing up as the opposite gender.
Exactly. So it's that thing of, like, if you can't, if you at least can't find a trans actor to play a trans role, at least find the right gender.
Mm. Yeah, not to mention, like, this one got me, and it's not so much connected with transness, but of course also is, because that whole situation is very ingrained in transness.
Yeah.
The fact that not only did they get a cisgendered woman, they got a thin cisgendered woman to play a fat trans man.
Yeah, and it's like, just so, it was so wrong.
What, were they going to put her in a fat suit or something? That would be even worse. Like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense in that situation. I do understand other situations, but that one, it just does not make any sense.
And then
to me,
she defended it. I can't remember the word she used, really.
She's like, hit up every other person that did it. And it's like, I know, everyone else was angry about it.
Exactly. And she, you know, she was quoting, like, people who, you know, society has moved on from that time. And, I mean, Felicity Huffman obviously was probably the one that people didn't get as angry about, because they actually cast, like, she was a cisgender woman playing a trans woman.
Yeah.
So it's not the thing where they're getting the gender wrong.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Actually, quite connected to that, in terms of just, like, people in the film industry in general, do you think there are obvious differences between a queer film made by a straight director and a queer film made by queer people?
Yes, absolutely. I think there are obviously exceptions to the rule. Yeah. I think Todd Haynes did a fantastic job with Carol, for instance. But I think particularly with lesbian films in general, I think that when you have a heterosexual man direct a lesbian film, it can be a bit of a
shit show.
I mean, sometimes they're okay. The sex scenes can be
gratuitous.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's the whole blue is the warmest colour situation where many a queer woman hate the sex scenes. I do know some queer women who liked those sex scenes. I was not one of them. I sat there with my straight female best friend watching it, and I was just like, this is really awkward. I swear we don't do that. But anyway, obviously, The Miseducation of Cameron Post is made by a queer woman in Desiree Akhavan. And I don't know if you've seen it, but the sex scenes in that felt so ridiculously authentic. Like, it wasn't, it was so clearly shot by a queer female as opposed to a queer, like, they weren't even really naked. Like, it was just fumbly and stupid, like teenage sex is. And it was hot at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, I can imagine that when a straight male director, for example, directs a queer female film, it could get sort of fetishized.
Yeah, absolutely.
By the director being like, this is what lesbians do.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
From all of the lesbian films I've seen, all of them being porn, this is definitely what lesbian ladies do. Put it in, Johnny. Yeah. Seems like that's the kind of vibe.
Yeah.
So let's
put it in, Johnny.
Let's move right to our very last question. What is your favourite LGBTQI+ focused film?
Oh, good Lord.
Right.
I do have to watch them for a living, you know. It's very hard to choose a favorite.
Be like a bad parent. Choose your favourite.
I'm thinking too. I can't think of mine.
Look, there's too many to name.
I love Big Eden.
Yeah, that is a dorky film.
It's
but
so dorky.
It is really dorky, but it is good. I think that's on Netflix. Look, gee, I'm a big fan of, because I have to watch so much queer cinema, I really am a big fan of films where it's got absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the person is queer. Like, that is, it's just that they chose to make this character queer. And that, our opening night film at Queer Skin Film Fest called And Breathe Normally is very much like that. The two lead characters are both queer, but the film really has nothing to do with that. There's a slight element for the refugee about that, but really it's not. And I think it's a beautiful film. It won at Sundance. And then there's another film that we're showing called Life in the Doghouse, which is about two older gay men who run a dog rescue. And they've rescued over 10,000 dogs. They have like up to 70 dogs living in their house at a time. So it's not about the fact that they're gay, but it's just this ridiculously positive, amazing couple who are like in their old, I think they're in the late 60s, early 70s. And there's just like, there's adorable dogs everywhere. And I have now adopted, well, not adopted, I'm fostering a rescue dog because I've watched that film.
Oh.
So come on down, watch it.
Queer screen saves dogs' lives.
Yeah.
Fact.
Absolutely. Fact. We do.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lisa. It's
my
been
absolute
fantastic.
Pleasure.
And that was Lisa Rose, Festival Director at Queer Screen.
So check out all their stuff. Go along. Go see some films.
Yeah, you can see their stuff on their website, which I'm pretty sure is just queerscreen.com.au.
Yeah, and just get around it. I say that after every interview. I'm just like, get around it. Don't miss it.
Don't just get around it.
Yeah, but
I think it's time for a bit of a special thing.
What do we think about it?
God, what do we think about it, though?
I love gay movies.
I love a good gay movie. I actually I looked on the Queer Screen website and they do a thing where it's like grants or something like that that they do each year for people who want to make queer films.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm actually interested in doing because I had an idea not too long ago, which is essentially a bit of a rom-com set at a high school. About a young girl who's coming to terms with her lesbianism. But she's desperately, and like everyone at her school knows that she is a lesbian, and she's got a big old crush on the popular girl at school whose name is Eleanor. And this literally came from me listening to the song Eleanor by the Turtles on repeat. So I'd want the soundtrack to purely be like old love song, like Eleanor by the Turtles, the Beach Boys, stuff like that. And so that's a really cool thing. If you are a queer filmmaker or you're interested in making queer films, definitely go check that out as well. I think that's super important.
And my film that we'll be releasing concurrently with Ruby's is it's just a doco on me exploring my passion for model building.
What kind of model building? Gundam?
Yes.
But like hot, sexy Gundam.
Hot, sexy Gundam.
So think Gundam robots, but just super hot and sexy.
Yeah. But like I'm a real lurker on the LGBTI section on Netflix.
Yeah.
It's there in documentaries where you can find me. There's a lot of good stuff. My personal favourite, which I didn't get to say at the end of the interview because I was rudely over-talked by Ruby. I'm kidding. I love her.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's Henry Gamble's birthday party.
Yeah. I heard about that.
I love it. And I love the main actor.
In love?
Yep. Hi, Cole. Yeah. Cole Doman.
Cole, I love you.
Cole, I love you.
I'm a big fan of, we actually talked about it, only the slightest bit. I just like name dropped it, but there's a movie I really like called Big Eden, which came out in 2001, and it's a gay movie, but it's a bit different to, you know, the
she's not like other gay movies.
it's a bit different in the sense that, like, a lot of the mainstream queer films are I'm sorry, a lot of the I've just got Patrick, like, putting on the cough button so he can drink his hot tea. We've got so the movie is, instead of being about young, hot gay men falling in love, it's a story of an older gay man moving back to his hometown after years of not being there anymore to take care of his sick dad or sick granddad, and also finding that his childhood best friend and also his unrequited love, unrequited crush, has also moved back after a divorce. But is it unrequited? You'll just have to watch the movie.
Oh, and the unrequited crush is a man.
Is a man.
Thus being gay.
And there might be another unrequited crush in there. And also all of this small town who is mostly old people are just all for it and cheering them on the whole time.
Gays.
It's really, really, really beautiful.
Yeah. And building upon the interview that we did have with Lisa, not a lot of lesbians.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Not a ton.
You've got a lot of air quote.
That
lesbian
Ruby Rose
films.
Very overworked.
Yeah. The only lesbian in Hollywood, Ruby Rose. You've got lesbian films not being made by lesbians that just not exactly a good example of the lesbian experience.
Yeah,
I would assume.
Two girls, one cup.
Oh, shut up. That's... I hate that you looked directly in the eyes of me when you said that. It really just burns me to my core. I hate it. And on that note, I think we have to go.
We have to go?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
We had a big ass long... Big ass. Big long ass... interview.
We did. It was a solid 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, by the way, thank you so much to Lisa.
Oh, yeah. Lisa was fantastic.
Amazing. 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 So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to our producers for producing. And coming up next is a bit of hardcore classic.
With Danny. Guys, we're sorry we're not going to be there this week to just, like,
dance
in the studio next to you. But just imagine we're in your studio. We're dancing on your hearts.
Yeah, we're dancing on the panel. Just squishing it. Just stomping our big-ass feet on the panel and having a dance.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. And we tried so hard to... this is just behind the scenes, some tea for yous. Yous. We tried so hard to find a song, and this is verbatim from me. I'm sure there's a gay song about movies.
And we really did try.
We searched gay songs about movies. Yeah. We couldn't find one, so we just thought, fuck it, let's just play Raining Men. It's Raining Men by the Weather Girls. It's great.
So, and that's what the Hank it be. It's Raining Men by the Weather Girls. You've been listening to It's a Gay Area on 2SCR 107.3 with me, Ruby.
And me, Patrick. Be careful when you go outside because it might be raining large men.
Hi, we're your Weather Girls.
Uh-huh.
And have we got news for you.
You better listen.
Get ready. Lonely girls, and leave those umbrellas.